is effective or not. So, Menaka.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. I enjoy that David said, I tried. So we'll, by the end of this talk, you can see if we succeeded on gathering this evidence or not. So first of all, I just want to thank the network for having me here today. It is such an honor to speak to you and to speak to all of you. And I know there's a lot of different stakeholders that are in this room. And I'm hoping that by the end of my talk, everyone can take a little something away. And I have no conflicts of interest that are relevant to disclose today. So today we're going to talk a little bit about basic concepts around guideline creation and how these concepts, which really speak directly to evidence gathering, are very challenging to apply to rare diseases like the ones you're dealing with. We're also going to be talking about some of the methods that we used for data gathering and synthesis on a recent evidence-based guideline for hemophilia care. And my hope is that as we walk through this guideline development process, we're going to be able to step beyond hemophilia a bit so you can apply these experiences in your work and hopefully meet that common goal, which is improving the lives of everyone living with rare blood disorders. We're going to start by discussing some fundamentals about guideline creation. So this is the official definition of clinical practice guidelines put forward by the World Health Organization. But actually, we're all sort of familiar with what guidelines are. We use them every day in clinical practice as physicians and nurses to give patients and families evidence-based care. And those of you who are patients know that you use them to make sure the care that you're getting meets a standard. I know that there are some payers and some policymakers in the room. Many of you are using guidelines to decide what to fund, what to support, and what to promote. So we make good decisions often based on guidelines, but I think we should start by acknowledging that a lot of the things that we do in medicine, and like a lot of the things we do in life, we really don't need guidelines at all. In fact, we don't even need to study them. So if you were very into skydiving, for example, you probably don't care that there's a systematic review of randomized controlled trials that actually confirms that parachutes reduce the risk of death by 99.9%. No, you would just use your historical understanding plus your common sense, and you would just use a parachute. Like, there's no uncertainty in this situation. We should all be funding parachutes, right? But sometimes, the decision-making is really hard. There's a lot of uncertainty. And in these areas, guidelines are very, very helpful. So as I said, we use guidelines when decision-making is hard. We use it when decision-making is risky. And we really use it when decision-making is expensive. In these situations, it behooves you to put a little bit more thought into things. So how do we make good decisions? Well, we can make good decisions if we understand the evidence behind what we're doing, when we can actually weigh the pros and cons, and ideally in medicine, when we personalize our decision-making to the patient or to the family that's sitting right in front of us, and when we formally assess all of these things, we end up with guidelines. Now, the problem is that there are a ton of barriers to guideline development in rare diseases. So the biggest barrier, as David has alluded to, is most often we simply don't have evidence. So I want you to think of evidence as a bridge. It's how we cross that chasm and how we get patients to optimal health states. So I'm going to give you an example bridge. So this year, Hypertension Canada published its 2017 guidelines on high blood pressure. Now, 25% of Canadians have high blood pressure. So there's a wealth of research evidence on this condition. So these hypertension guidelines have a good evidence base. They're supported by a strong bridge. Now I want to think about the diseases of interest to this network. So the prevalence of hemophilia is about 1 in 5,000 males. Hereditary angioedema affects about 1 in 50,000. So think about that bridge. The evidence to feed guidelines in these areas is considerably shakier. But you know what? We still have to cross the river. We can't tell individuals affected by this disease, too bad, the bridge is kind of scary, why don't you all just sit tight with what you're dealing with? So even if we can accumulate some published evidence on rare diseases, it may not be the kind of evidence that we want. So we know that published studies in rare disease are often very heterogeneous, so it's like a hodgepodge of studies and case reports, and the patients are different, and the interventions are different, and the way that we're measuring outcomes is different. As a methodologist, I find it very hard to combine those results and give people a clear message on what to do. We also know that there's a lack of data on key patient important outcomes. So those of you who are patients sitting in this room know that quality of life is probably your number one priority every day. Guess what? There's not a lot of good, reliable ways to measure quality of life in a patient-reported way. So all these studies that look at all these outcomes, many of them don't talk about how patients are feeling at the end of the day. So when you have this slim and inconsistent body of evidence, it is really, really hard to distill it. So how do we overcome the barriers? As I said, we need to cross the river together. So I'm going to talk to you about our guideline project that applied some novel strategies to this problem, and I hope it can be applied to some of your diseases of interest as well. So in 2012, the National Hemophilia Foundation, which is a nonprofit, patient-driven organization based in the U.S., held a strategic summit to talk about the evolving U.S. healthcare environment. And at the end of the summit, they decided that there needed to be an increased emphasis on evidence-based care for hemophilia. And this group, this patient group, decided to sponsor evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. This is the first patient group to ever do so. And the goal was really to develop guidelines not just for doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers, but guidelines that really mattered to patients. So a working group kind of brainstormed ideas for the inaugural guideline topic. It was the usual suspects, right? There was, should we use prophylaxis, inhibitors, prevention, home treatment. But ultimately, the NHF did not do a guideline on what care people with hemophilia needed. They did a guideline on how that care should be delivered. So they commissioned a guideline on models of care. There's many guidance documents, David can tell you about all of them, that really advocate for integrated or comprehensive care as the best model of care for people with hemophilia. But none of these actually looked at the evidence. They never actually looked at the impact of comprehensive care on patient important health outcomes. So this guideline compared three things. It compared integrated care, or comprehensive care settings. These are in Canada called the hemophilia treatment centers. In the U.S., comprehensive care to them means a group of federally funded hemophilia treatment centers of excellence. And they hit all of the points that David's mentioned. So they bring together multidisciplinary teams. There's often high involvement of patient associations. A lot of them do significant outreach to outlying areas. So that was the first thing we were comparing. The other was specialists in a non-specialized setting. So this would be a hematologist working solo in their own clinic with no help from other providers. And then the third thing was non-specialists in a non-specialized setting. So these are family physicians or eMERGE doctors who see people with hemophilia sort of on an as-needed basis and often without a lot of experience and expertise. Now, the aim of the guideline was to compare all these things and really figure out which the winner was, and also to look at the integrated care team itself and say, what's the core complement of services? What's the core complement of providers that we really need to include? So the goal of the guideline was, as I said, really twofold: identify best practices in care delivery, and then really support patient-centered clinical decision-making. So, you know, take this knowledge out to the people who really matter and empower them to make good choices and advocate for themselves. So right from the start, it was important for us to develop the guideline using transparent, internationally accepted processes. I'm not going to go into these in too much detail, but one thing I want to mention is the thing in the top right corner, which is called GRADE. This is a really geeky type of guideline methodology. It basically is a roadmap. It's a very rigorous roadmap that lays out what we need to do to make the guideline. So it touches on, you know, who should be on the panel, how do you manage their conflicts of interest, how do you gather evidence, how do you synthesize it mathematically, how do you word the recommendations. We wanted to do this because we knew that our bridge was going to be shaky, right? We knew there probably wasn't going to be a lot of evidence, but we wanted people to know that we were trying to do the best we can, and we wanted to be really transparent about what we were doing. The first step whenever you do a guideline is to start with questions. And for this guideline, we drafted two sets of questions. We vetted them using electronic surveys sent out to stakeholders, which obviously includes patients, and then we sent it to the panel to review and refine. So our first question was, should integrated care versus non-integrated care be used? Okay. And the second question is, for individuals with hemophilia, should this team be part of the comprehensive care center, or should there be a team with a lesser complement? We also looked at outcomes of interest that were important to patients, and this was also an incredible experience. I'm a hematologist. That's my day job. So it was pretty amazing to see what, you know, my patients were saying about the outcomes. I thought certain things would be really important, like the number of bleeds somebody has a year, and the patients told me, no, that's really dumb. We have hemophilia. We have a bleeding disorder. We know we bleed. You know what we care about? We care about having bleeds that make us miss work or make us miss school. We care about educational attainment. We care about whether we live or die. They clearly told us about the outcomes that mattered to them. We also had payers and policymakers at the table, so they told us about outcomes that would help move the needle in terms of seeking funding for some of these interventions we were studying. So again, you know, really great argument to not just have a bunch of hematologists at the table when you do guidelines. This is where my work began, because in this project I was more of a methodologist than a hematologist. We needed to answer our guideline questions, and we started by just searching for published evidence. And we wanted to answer our questions with direction. So we wanted to say, you know, what's the pros and cons? Should we choose integrated care or should we not? We also wanted to give answers with strength, so we wanted to use really good evidence. We didn't just want to look at case studies and people's, you know, blog posts about what the best type of care was. We wanted to ideally look for randomized trials. We wanted to look for systematic reviews. And what I want you to note is when I talk about giving answers, we just didn't want to speak to the outcomes that our patients and our other stakeholders had named. We also wanted to delve a little deeper. We wanted to talk to patients about their values and preferences. How did certain types of care make them feel? How did they meet their overall needs? We want to talk about equity. So it's great in a guideline to recommend something, but then if that something isn't feasible, if it's not fundable, if it creates huge inequities across the population where some people can access that care and some people can't, you know, you're not really doing the right thing with your guidelines. So we wanted to think about that. And we wanted to think about resource use. So please remember that the NHF is a U.S. organization, and their healthcare system is going through like almost hourly change right now, right? And the Canadian healthcare system, there are real realities at the federal and provincial level. So not looking at resource use in a guideline is really a grave mistake. It's really a way to set yourself up for failure. So we did this big literature search. And unfortunately, it was a total failure. It was an absolute failure. So we found no systematic reviews. We found no randomized trials. We found 24 narrative papers. These are like the blog posts I was talking about. This is some physician talking about their experience in a purely qualitative way with no numbers. We did find about 26 studies that were non-randomized. That was sort of the best we can do. And so what I can distill for you, just to show you the misery that we put our grad students to, we screened about 7,000 papers, and we only identified 51 original studies. The high quality of evidence on hemophilia was really scarce, and this should not be a surprise to any of you working in the rare disorder space. So with so little published evidence to guide us, we couldn't even start building the bridge, so we needed to get creative to fill in the gaps, and I hope some of the things we did will spark something in you, and I know that many of you are actually doing this work already. So we needed to think out of the box. Oh, not sure what happened there. Okay. A higher power is guiding my slides. So it's always nice when there's somebody at a booth to fix things for you. Yeah, you can just click in. I'll find where we are. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. All right. So I'm just going to flip back. So we're going to talk about what we did to fill in the gaps. So the first thing we did was we did something called parallel searches of other diseases. So what we did is we took that same search strategy and we just repeated the systematic review, but we took the easy way out. We decided to see how do comprehensive care models work in more common diseases with more published evidence. So we chose four common diseases: congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, and diabetes. And you might think, well, why did you pick those? Those have nothing to do with hemophilia. Well, they have a lot, actually, to do with hemophilia. Like hemophilia, they are chronic. These are all high-resource-use diseases. Some diseases like asthma and diabetes can affect individuals over the lifespan, which, you know, definitely hemophilia does. And most importantly, all of these diseases, in the U.S. and in Canada sometimes, deliver care via very well-established comprehensive care models. So they're already in the space, and they're generating data. They have many more numbers, so the data that they're generating is likely higher quality. So we found all of that evidence, and then we gave it to our guideline panel, which is our group of stakeholders. And we asked them, well, look at this evidence in asthma and tell us whether you think it is direct enough. Tell us whether you can extrapolate and use this stuff to inform some of our recommendations for hemophilia. And the use of indirect evidence is actually a legitimate thing to do. So this sounds a bit shady, but it's actually a well-accepted way to address rare diseases. Guideline developers, if they don't find enough published evidence in their space, they're actually encouraged to step out and look for other evidence and try to extrapolate. And this is just an example of one of the things that we gave our panel. We talked about a study in asthma. We talked about a clinic where care was provided by nurses and GPs. And we talked about some of the outcomes that they valued, like missed days of school or work. And basically, we asked the panel to look at this study and send back this little questionnaire on how indirect or direct they thought the evidence was. So this method of extrapolation actually worked well, and we were able to generate a lot of material to work with. We also filled in the gaps using a qualitative interview-based study, and I think this is going to be particularly relevant to the patients in the room. So as I mentioned earlier, we wanted to look at quite a bit of information to make good recommendations. So we didn't just want to consider the treatment about in terms of basic healthcare outcomes. We wanted to ask what outcomes are valued, what outcomes do patients care about. Is the model of care making a difference in ways that really matter? But it's very difficult to find published evidence on this. Again, a lot of it is just sort of commentary and opinion. So we decided just to go right to the source. We used social media. Our young grad students actually used social media to recruit patients. And we ended up doing 29 semi-structured telephone interviews in 18 states representing 26 different hemophilia treatment centers. And amazingly, we didn't just get patients. We actually found that policymakers were volunteering for these anonymous interviews, and clinicians were telling us sort of the pros and cons professionally for them working in these comprehensive care centers. The interviews were amazing, and they were like long interviews. These interviewees were really game for talking for hours about their experiences, and many of them said, this is the first time anyone's asked me about this. This is the first time anyone's asked me what it's like to travel an hour to a comprehensive care center and pay for parking and have to miss a day of work to care for my child. Or this is the first time anyone's asked me what it's like to be in a center where there's no comprehensive care and the stress that that puts on my family, the stress that that puts on me, not knowing. So we used something called thematic content analysis to analyze these interviews. We learned so much. We learned how access to care is impacted by things like age, by ethnicity, geography, socioeconomic concerns. Patients told us what parts of the comprehensive care team they really valued. They told us what parts they didn't particularly value. Providers told us what it felt like to work in these centers where the funding model was different. They told us about the professional factors that made things enjoyable. They also admitted to some professional factors that made this work very stressful for them, and all of it was good, novel information, which does not exist in the published literature right now. And then the final way we filled in the gaps in the data was through something called structured expert observations. So, what is this? Well, it's often the case in rare diseases like hemophilia, like HAE, PID, there's not a lot of published evidence to guide practice, but there's often quite a bit of experiential knowledge, and that's usually from healthcare providers who've had years and years of real-world experience treating patients. Now, these people are inarguably experts, right? There's also quite a bit of knowledge in the patients who've had years and years of living with the disease, and they are also experts. Now, individually, any one of these individuals probably doesn't have enough knowledge to publish a peer-reviewed study, or a journal won't care to publish a study on a disease like this. But when taken together, these experiences called expert observations are really invaluable. So we use surveys to systematically capture clinical observations from the guideline panel, from other individuals identified as experts in the field, and we got them to sign off on these expert observations. So it was very transparent who was saying what. So we were able to pull out really amazing data. So for example, one of our panel members was from the Centers for Disease Control, and he had this amazing study on the impact of physiotherapists in his comprehensive care network, which is all of the comprehensive care centers in the States, but it had never been published, partly because he just hadn't gotten around to publishing it, but also because he didn't think there was any interest. And then we asked him for it, and we got this amazing dump of data. It was fantastic. And we were able to collate it and present it to the guideline panel. And that was just a gold mine that we never would have found if we hadn't asked. So after everything, after all the data was collected and synthesized, we had to answer our questions. We had to make our final recommendations. So I'm going to walk you through them quickly. So the first recommendation is that for persons with hemophilia, the integrated or comprehensive care model should be used over non-integrated care models. So if you look at our three options, this was the winner. But please notice that there's a little box at the end which explains that recommendation. It was a conditional recommendation based on moderate certainty in the evidence. So what does that mean? What it means is that there was some debate about the magnitude of the benefits. There was an acknowledgement that the evidence we were using was of really variable quality. These were not the hypertension guidelines. But looking at everything we gave them, the panel felt that there was a clear balance in favor of the integrated care option. And here's what they based it on. First of all, they said, listen, it appears that there is a complete absence of health harms in doing this. It also is clear that in more common diseases, like, you know, congestive heart failure, there's a clear balance that there is benefit, that this is actually making patients feel better, live longer, have better lives. The panel also felt that when you think about things like health equity and feasibility, access to care in remote areas, that comprehensive care was a clear winner in all of them. And finally, they spoke about resource use. So I want you to think back to David's silo slides. So this is kind of an amazing picture. It's the first time I've ever seen the numbers set out in that way with the silos, but it illustrates what the panel was thinking about. So for this question, resource use was really challenging to assess. And that is because, as David said, clotting factor concentrates, they take up 93% of the pie, 93% of total direct medical costs for persons with hemophilia. The panel decided to take those costs off the table. And they said, listen, what we're left with is 7%. We're left with a tiny little fraction of the pie. That's the additional cost of doing care in a comprehensive way. And they said, when we look at the benefits and the total absence of harms, that little 7%, this is worth it. This is a good return on investment. And in fact, the payers who are sitting around the table, the people like from insurance companies and from government, from Medicare, were saying, listen, it's clear, everything you've shown us, that this model provides optimal care, that it's streamlined, that it's more efficient. It actually reduces that 93% piece of the pie because it actually involves teaching patients how to use factor products more efficiently. It prevents the development of things like inhibitors, which we know really, really drive up that 93% cost. So they felt that this was sort of a no-brainer from an implementation. It really speaks to the penny-wise, pound-foolish. They said, wow, we're really being pound-foolish if we don't do this. And again, you know, the jargon basically might make you doubt this recommendation, but I would encourage you to look at the guideline and look at all of our interpretive comments and see why we felt very strongly about this. We also made an extra sort of recommendation for people with inhibitors who are at high risk for inhibitor development, and we made an even stronger recommendation for those folks. And the reason is because these people, because the relative benefits are so big, they felt that comprehensive care would make even more of a difference to them. They would get even more of that education, that support, that education on judicious product use that could really help save their lives and make them live better. And again, you know, you don't have to pay attention to the jargon. You need to pay attention to the intent of what we are saying, which we hope we put out clearly in our guideline. Now, the second question was actually the hard one. It was much harder, and it talks about who should actually be on the comprehensive care team, right? What are the sort of bang for your buck components? We really struggled with this. There was absolutely no evidence here. We certainly did talk to a lot of stakeholders. There's a study called the HERO study, which has come out, which did give us some insight. But basically, when we looked at everything, our panel felt that the team as it exists in the United States, and the team is listed up there, is probably the team that would show the most benefit, because it seems that having that full complement is something that is appreciated and enjoyed by patients. We were not able to tease out what's the relative benefit of the doctor or the nurse, or you know, how much value does a physiotherapist or a social worker add, and that is very challenging. But what it means is that just because we can't tease it out doesn't mean we shouldn't start asking those questions in a rigorous way. So I'm going to close my presentation with some next steps and some sort of closing words about this guideline. Like, how do we use this guideline? What does it mean to us in hemophilia? What does it mean to all of you who don't have hemophilia? Well, guidelines really impact three major domains. They definitely impact patient care. That's the easy one. They also impact implementation. They tell, at the macro level, they tell us what to do, what to fund, what to promote. And ideally, they should really focus on promoting research. And we felt that our guidelines spoke to all of these areas. So one very important thing we wanted to talk about was implementation. So what was a clear message from our interviews is that the issue of comprehensive care really speaks to access. And we felt that even with a hemophilia treatment center network in the United States, that some persons with hemophilia still had barriers to accessing care, and there was a call for a national effort to look into this. So what does age matter? How does geography tell us if patients can access care? Are there issues with race and ethnicity? We believe there are. It's not so much an issue here, but does insurance status matter? There's also a call to look at the capacity of these centers. You know, if we do build a network, how do we keep them going? How do we make sure they can take enough people in? And how do we establish stable funding streams for these centers? I think that's important no matter what jurisdiction you're in. There was certainly a call to standardize components of the integrated care team, you know, figure out who has the most bang for the buck and who the core group should be in every center. There is a need to train, recruit, and retain specialized healthcare team members. So I've had the opportunity, for example, to work with some amazing hemophilia nurses. These people are like gold. They're a dime a dozen in some places. They are incredibly rare in other places. So how do you take these really specialized care providers and ensure that they're distributed? One of the ways we can do that is to make it attractive for them to work as hemophilia nurses, right? We can remunerate them properly. We can give them opportunities for training and career advancement. And if you're going to set up a comprehensive care network, you really need to think about how are we going to get the absolute best people who are committed to helping our patients and families. There's also a need to develop and track performance measures. So David referred to this as post-marketing surveillance. So once you do this, once you set up these networks, how do you make sure they're working? How do you make sure that they're actually meeting the goals and the needs that they said that they were going to meet? And can we set up systems, and certainly this is popular in the U.S. and is growing in popularity here, how do we set up performance tracking to show that we're meeting goals and therefore we should continue to get resources to keep the lights on? Definitely we feel that this guideline is going to improve care, definitely at the macro level. The reality is that payers, insurers, hospitals, federal and provincial healthcare systems, they depend on good evidence when they decide what to fund. We should not be funding things based on who is shouting the loudest. We should be funding things based on rational, well-thought strategies of care. And we felt our guideline was the beginning of this. It's a framework that we can use to evaluate the successes and the shortcomings of this model of care. It definitely confirms that comprehensive care matters to patients. It confirms that HTCs in the U.S. are providing incredibly high-quality care for hemophilia, despite the ups and downs of funding. And it suggested some ways that these centers can be a value add. And again, as David said, you can use comprehensive care centers to track the safety and efficacy of therapies. You can use it to develop and quickly disseminate cost-effective treatment paradigms, not just locally, but across an entire disease. I mean, that's amazing. And certainly as a physician, that's very appealing to feel like you're part of something bigger when you're trying to help your patients. The guideline is also aimed at individual healthcare providers and researchers. It, again, suggests evidence-based performance benchmarks. It tells us what we should be doing and promoting when we talk to our patients. And it tells us as researchers what kind of work we should be doing. So as I said, we screened 7,000 studies. We ended up with 51 not great studies. So as somebody who is a researcher, I would like to add to the body of literature, I'd like to add some value. And what that would tell me is maybe I should start looking more rigorously at how we deliver care. Maybe I should start answering questions that are important to patients in my research. And I hope that research-granting bodies, people who give money to researchers, look at guidelines as well, because we really should be funding research that addresses gaps in our intelligence. Most importantly, NHF, as I said, is a patient organization. It provides guidance for patients and families by establishing a standard of care. I really hope our guideline empowers patients to communicate with their providers. So, for example, there's a small center in the States where there's no physiotherapist for the hemophilia patients. And so we actually heard back from this chapter of NHF that they were using our guideline to start advocating for this healthcare provider to be added to their core complement. Our guideline does acknowledge that every patient has unique needs, but we think it also sets that minimum standard that needs to be met. As I mentioned, research and comprehensive care go hand in hand. We are very excited because the HTCs in the U.S. have expressed an interest in really enhancing their data collection and analysis capacity. So you think about all these centers, they're all collecting data on their patients, and they've expressed a willingness to conduct high-quality, well-organized studies to fund the next guideline that we do. Our guideline, we were so proud. It was endorsed by a number of federations and associations that really matter to us and matter to patients. It was included in the National Guideline Clearinghouse, so you can actually find our guideline on the internet if you would like. And it was disseminated through publication in our journal, which is Hemophilia. And again, these are sort of the in-depth details, and you're welcome to read about them if you'd like. I'd be happy to discuss them with you. But my goal today is to really focus on the big picture. You may not all be interested in hemophilia, but hopefully this can speak to your disease areas. I think rare diseases are a real challenge to guideline methodologists. So our hope, my group at McMaster, is that we're trying to develop really rigorous but really creative strategies to form guidelines that improve patient care for people affected by rare diseases. It may involve extrapolating for more common diseases. It may involve just going out to the field and interviewing stakeholders. But this guideline shows that it can be done. I'm personally and professionally a believer that comprehensive care really does offer high-quality, multifaceted care for persons with hemophilia. And when you look at the overall profile, it's a clear win. The pros are outweighing the cons. And based on what you all will be talking about today, I think exploring and clarifying that message for other disease conditions, I think that's a very achievable goal. So thank you to the hardworking guideline panel, to our amazing team at NHF and McMaster, to the people who work to optimize bleeding disorder care every day, and thank you to all of you for listening to me this morning.